Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a proposal to raise the cost of dog licenses. But up front, the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday revived a former student's lawsuit against the college he attended that blocked his evangelizing on campus, with Chief Justice John Roberts casting a lone dissenting vote. The issue was not the conduct of the college, which kept students from spreading the gospel on campus. The issue was whether the student's demand the college pay him a nominal amount of money in damages, which could be as little as $1, kept his civil rights case alive, or whether it was moot once the university agreed to his complaint and ended its offending speech policy. Justice Clarence Thomas said the request for nominal damages was enough to keep the suit alive, and the other members of the court, except Roberts, agreed with him. It was an 8-1 opinion. But in his dissent, Roberts said that risk a major expansion of the federal court's role, and that once the college stopped its alleged unconstitutional actions, there was nothing more for the plaintiff to gain. So it raises a lot of questions. Joining us is Michael R. Domino, professor of law at Widener University Commonwealth Law School. Professor Domino, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be back here.
If you'd like to weigh in on this case, other things related to the Supreme Court or courts, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So why would the court revive a case that has already been settled?
Well, it hasn't really been settled. At least that's the holding of the court. What the court says is that when you ask, when you, the plaintiff, ask for the court to vindicate your constitutional rights and you ask for some amount of relief, it doesn't matter how much money you ask for. If you ask for $1 million and the college doesn't want to give it to you, then your suit is alive. And if you ask for $1 and the college doesn't want to give it to you, then your suit is alive.
But in this case, and let's face it, you know, we're talking about one case here, but the why this is significant is it could establish precedent. But in this case, the college changed what their policy that could have been ruled unconstitutional. The student accepted it. A federal court, a lower court, dismissed the case because the college had, had made changes. So if a lower court has dismissed it without precedent, all the remedies have occurred on the campus of this college. Why would, again, I'll ask the question that with all that context of why the court would revive it with all that taking place in the background.
I think that there are two things that the plaintiff asked for. He initially, when he filed the suit, he wanted some kind of remedy for the harm that had already been done to him, and he wanted to be able to evangelize in the future. And the college did take care of one of those. It said, eventually, it said, we realize that our policy is unconstitutional. We're going to get rid of it, and we're going to let you evangelize in the future. And so the plaintiff said, okay, that part of the suit is done. But what isn't done is providing a remedy for what happened to me in the past. Earlier, I had tried to spread my word. I had tried to speak on the campus, and you prevented me from doing that. I'm entitled to damages. It's just like if suppose you're complaining about some aspect of unconstitutional conduct that the government is engaged in. Maybe the government is discriminating against you because of your race. If the government says, okay, well, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to discriminate against you anymore. Well, that solves the future problem, but it doesn't address any kind of problem for the harm that the government caused you for discriminating against you in the past. And what the court said here was that the nominal damages that he wanted and the college didn't want to pay him are a remedy for what happened to him in the past.
Mm-hmm. Chief Justice Roberts said that this could expand the court's jurisdiction. In what way?
What Chief Justice Roberts is concerned about is having the courts used as a tool of policy. He doesn't like the idea that people can go into court if they have a particular ideological interest and use a lawsuit as a way of affecting policy. He's indicated that concern of his in many other cases in his 15 years on the court. And that, I think, is what is behind his decision this week. Mm-hmm. Now, as to how much it's actually going to expand the jurisdiction of the court, that's a little bit unclear. I think he's being a little bit hyperbolic in his language. As the rest of the court pointed out, they still these suits would still be able to go forward as long as the request was for a larger amount of money. So I'm not sure how many cases would have been kicked out that that are in a situation just like this, where the only thing that survives is nominal damages. But what's driving Roberts is that he doesn't want the courts to be, as he called, advice columnists. He doesn't want them just to be involved, just to give an answer to a question about whether your rights have been violated, if it doesn't really matter, if there's nothing that really depends on the outcome of the suit, like a request for an injunction or a request that the defendant pay a large amount of money.
And along those lines, what the Chief Justice said is that going forward, the judiciary will be required to perform this function whenever a plaintiff asks for a dollar. For those who want to know if their rights have been violated, the least dangerous branch will become the least expensive source of legal advice. I mean, I have to admit that one of the things I thought of, and granted, this is by Roberts' description here or his warnings, is that there would be many more cases that would come before the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, for them to decide with nominal damages. Is that a potential outcome of this, or is this, again, just Roberts kind of exaggerating?
It's certainly possible that there are going to be some increase in the number of cases that come to the federal courts, not just the U.S. Supreme Court, but all federal courts, because the holding today applies to all federal courts. But I don't think that it's going to be all that much an increase. I don't think there's going to be a substantial number of cases that would have been dismissed, but that aren't going to be in light of this week's ruling.
This was an 8-1 ruling with Chief Justice Roberts as the lone dissenter. Conservative and liberal wings of the court, as they've been described, agreeing. Does that happen very often?
It happens extremely often that there is a 9-0 or 8-1 decision at the U.S. Supreme Court. What is unusual about it is that Roberts is the one who was dissenting. So, in fact, it's so unusual, it's unique. This is the only time in Chief Justice Roberts' tenure on the court when he has been the sole dissenter. He has dissented many times in the past, but he has always been joined by at least one other justice. So it's not unusual for the liberal and conservative wings to agree. What is unusual is that the liberal and conservative wings agree without the middle agreeing.
You know, and I point that out because, you know, often when we hear about controversial cases and when we hear about cases that have been decided by the Supreme Court, we hear about those ones that are contentious, that have a close vote, or, you know, whenever there is a justice that has been nominated, will this be the conservative that will, you know, make it a 6-3, like all rulings are 6-3 or 5-4. And as you're pointing out, most of them have major agreement amongst the justices. Is that an accurate portrayal of this?
Yes, and it's even more the case in the lower courts. The lower courts, where the law tends to be more clear, finds much more agreement between appointees of Republican and Democratic presidents. The other thing that's worth pointing out is that decisions on the U.S. Supreme Court are not all about abortion or affirmative action. And so the typical liberal conservative split doesn't show up in all these cases. Sometimes you have a disagreement on the court about things like judicial power. How active should courts be in whatever ideological direction? Should courts be available to vindicate constitutional rights, or should courts be use their power in a more reserved kind of way? Sometimes the justices disagree about those questions in ways that differ from the usual, or what we think of as the usual, kind of ideological split.
We have a question here from a listener who wants to know, what's the purpose of nominal damages?
The purpose of nominal damages is in some ways the same kind of purpose as a declaratory judgment. You go into court and you say, I think that my constitutional rights have been violated, and I want the court to say so. I want there to be something on paper that says that I'm right, that my constitutional rights were violated. Now that can be really important to some people who say that I'm going into court and it's the principle of the thing. It's not money that matters. Other times, nominal damages can be a hook for attorney's fees and other kinds of costs. So the amount of damages that a plaintiff receives might be very low, but if the defendant is required to pay the plaintiff's attorney's fees, that amount could end up being in the thousands of dollars. So in a case like this, where you start out with a case that involves a request for injunctive relief and for nominal damages, the injunctive case might settle, but the attorneys might have put in a lot of money, a lot of time, and might submit a bill to the plaintiff for a fair amount of money. Well, the plaintiff might be able to recover that if he gets an award of attorney's fees from the court that requires the defendant to pay that, which he might if he also gets nominal damages, but he wouldn't if he just gives up on the case.
You know, something I've always wondered about, Michael, is that, you know, what it costs to take a case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, every case is different, and just what you said about attorneys investing a lot of time and a lot of effort, a lot of money into a case obviously has an influence. But is it expensive to take a case to the U.S. Supreme Court?
It is if you have to fund it yourself, as most businesses do and a lot of individuals do. There are some exceptions to that. There are a lot of interest groups that have lawyers who take cases for less than the usual fee. Some of them do it for no fee. In criminal cases, as you know, sometimes the criminal attorney is appointed by the government, and so it's no cost at all to the criminal defendant who wants to bring and appeal the case. But yes, if you have to fund litigation yourself, it's many thousands of dollars to go through any level of court system, and the U.S. Supreme Court just adds another level on top of litigation that's already expensive.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's program, a significant report that found a huge amount of microplastics in Pennsylvania waterways. In fact, every one of the Pennsylvania waterways that were tested for microplastics contained them. And there's a quote from a local college professor who says that the human beings in Pennsylvania ingest enough microplastics in a week's time to make a credit card. That's right. We'll be coming up on that will be coming up on tomorrow's program. But our guest today during this portion of the program is Michael R. Domino. He's a professor of law at Widener University's Commonwealth Law School. We started off by talking about a case this week in the U.S. Supreme Court that U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts was the lone dissenter, first time in his 16 years on the bench that he was the lone dissenter in a case involving nominal damages. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Michael, I want to go back to this case for just a moment and then go on to some other issues. But Chief Justice Roberts, you said a few minutes ago, you said about the conservative wing, the liberal wing, and in this case, in the middle. Do you consider the Chief Justice in the middle, or are you just talking figuratively?
No, in most issues, or at least the issues that are more likely to show up in the news, I think that he is. There are the current three liberals on the court. Justice Sotomayor is probably the most liberal, followed by Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer. And I think that they're all more liberal than he is. And I think that the other members of the court, with the possible exception of Kavanaugh, who's not especially conservative, but the others are more conservative than Roberts is on the issues that tend to show up in the newspaper. The ones that there obviously are some cases where he's going to take what would be labeled a conservative position, and usually dismissing a case, keeping a case out of federal court, is usually labeled as a conservative position. But like you've pointed out today, that doesn't really match up with how the case vote is, because the liberals and conservatives on the court both wanted to keep the courtroom doors open to vindicate constitutional rights. In this case, the person who was the plaintiff was a religious speaker, and so we might identify that as a conservative litigant who's using the court to vindicate his religious and free speech rights. But the liberals have often and historically have been even more insistent on keeping the courts open to vindicate constitutional claims, because it is quite often groups on the left side of the political spectrum, environmental groups and whatnot, that most want to get into court, even though it's hardest for them to demonstrate the kind of monetary damages that typically get people into court, that give them what we call standing to sue.
You know, I've often heard it reported that Chief Justice Roberts, that the legacy of his court is important to him. Is this first of all, do you think that's accurate? And secondly, is this a case that maybe he's looking toward that legacy?
Yes to both questions. I think that the legacy of the court is certainly important to him. I think it's important to all public officials who've reached the kind of level that he has in American government. After all, I mean, we call it the Roberts Court, so it would be very surprising if he weren't concerned about the legacy of an institution that he's already led for more than a decade and a half. This case, I don't think it's the case especially, but I do think it's the issue that matters to him. I think that it's extremely important to Chief Justice Roberts that the federal courts be perceived as an institution that resolves legal disputes and that is different from the political branches of government. I think that it's extremely important to him that the courts actually perform and be thought of as performing a function that is different from the Congress and the president, that we the public shouldn't go to the court expecting them to act on whatever kinds of policies we or the judges think would be good. I think it's extremely important to him that we have a vision of the courts that the legal game that they are playing is different from the political game that's being played in the other branches of government.
We have a couple questions along those lines. Abby emails us and asks, I understand that this course of action can be expensive, an expensive remedy to civil problems, but how else can the average citizen affect policy change? Passing actual legislation is extremely difficult and slow, and most citizens don't have access beyond writing a letter or sending an email. How would you respond to that, Mike?
I think that that's true, but that's the consequence of us living in a nation of 330 million people. The ability of any one of us to affect policy is low, but it should be. That's what democracy is. If one person could affect policy when 300 million other people don't want that policy to be in effect, then you're undermining democracy. And so I think that there's a plus and a minus to having the courts being involved in making policy decisions. If you like how the courts come out, then it's great. But if you don't, and you have a majority behind you, then you look at what the courts making policy as tyrannical. You take it as a little group of people, an elite group of lawyers that's undermining democracy if they make policy that is contrary to what the democratic branches want.
Let's take a phone call from Greg in New York. Greg, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, thanks for taking my call this morning.
Yes, you're welcome.
So my understanding of the Supreme Court is that their role is to rule on the constitutionality of a lower court's ruling. And in this case, since there was no ruling from the lower court, in my opinion, and I guess in what Justice Roberts is saying, is that they shouldn't be hearing this case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for your call. I think Greg kind of goes to the heart of the matter, at least as Robert sees it.
Yeah, I think that he basically does. Now, the lower court ruling dismissed the case. The case, there was a motion to dismiss filed on the ground that there is no more standing. The case is moot. And the lower court agreed. They granted that motion. They dismissed the case. The U.S. Supreme Court said that decision was wrong. So the U.S. Supreme Court isn't deciding the whole case. They're just deciding that the dismissal was improper. And so they send the case back to the lower courts and say, we're reversing your dismissal decision. Now you have to continue on with the case.
We have a question here from Amber, who's a student at Millersville University. She says, in response to nominal fees, do you think this would open a door for others to say, hey, I think my rights have been violated. I'm going to take this to court, maybe just to be reimbursed or to get some free money from their college?
Yes, but I think we're already there. I think that we have the all-purpose civil rights statute in the United States Code allows people to sue when their constitutional rights have been violated. The only difference about this case was that in the typical case, you ask for damages in the thousands of dollars, and here the plaintiff was satisfied with a judgment for just a couple of dollars. So we're already in the situation that question hypothesizes. You can already get into court if you think your rights have been violated to try to get money from whoever violated your rights.
Let's take a call from Dan in Elizabethtown. Dan, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, Professor DeMino. I had you back in 2008. My question for you is, if the court were to adopt, as Robert suggests, a line between what damages are too nominal for a case to proceed and what damages are sufficient, don't you think plaintiffs who want their case to be heard would just state a claim for an amount $1 over whatever that limit was?
Mike, what about that?
Always insightful questions from the former students. Thank you for calling in. Yes, the answer to that is yes, although I suspect that the rule that Roberts would have wanted is not just a dollar figure limit, but instead is a categorical limit between what we call compensatory damages and nominal damages. Compensatory damages have as the principle, we're going to compensate you for the injury. We're going to figure out how much you have been injured in monetary terms, and we're going to force the defendant to pay you that amount. Nominal damages, we're not even trying to come up with that number. We say we don't, we can't prove the amount of actual damage, and we're not going to try. We're just going to put $1 as a kind of symbol. It's a symbolic victory rather than an attempt to compensate the plaintiff. But Dan's question is right, that if there was a rule that we had to plead real damages to stay in court, then that's what plaintiffs would do. And they would name some figure of compensatory damages. Now, of course, they'd have to make some kind of showing that they're entitled to it. So if you get a situation like this, where the plaintiff is prohibited from speaking and asks for $10,000 as compensation for that harm, at some point he'd have to be able to explain why the damage is worth $10,000. But yes, I imagine that he would plead those damages and would make an effort to prove them so as to stay in court.
I want to move on to another issue, but it's related to some of the things we talked about. Former President Trump was disappointed and maybe even surprised that the justices he appointed didn't agree with him on some of their rulings, especially related to the election in November. But that's not unusual, is it?
No, it's not. It's one of the benefits of our constitutional system. It's one of the aspects of the genius of our constitutional framers, that they set up a system of courts that guarantees tenure and salary protection to judges so that they can rule in cases in ways that they think are right, even if those decisions are unpopular with the public or unpopular with the people who are currently in the other branches of government. So they have the ability, they have the wherewithal to say, Mr. President, I may be grateful for the appointment that you've given me, but I think that your legal position is wrong, and I'm going to rule against you. There are other countries where the situation is what's kind of colloquially known as telephone justice, where the judges get a call from the people who have political power, and those officials tell the judges which way they're going to decide the case. And telephone justice is no justice. The justice that we have in the United States is far superior because the framers have given judges life tenure and salary protection that give them this ability to decide cases based on what they think the law requires.
You know, we had a caller who asked a question, is there really a conservative wing, a liberal wing, and is a moderate considered a liberal? Along those lines, just an observation, it seems that the courts have become more politicized, at least by the people who aren't on those courts. You know, I often hear reported that a ruling was made by a court made up of so many Trump appointees, or in Pennsylvania, so many Democrats and Republicans. Does this politics, does this politicization, there I'll get the word out yet, carry over into the courts?
I have trouble pronouncing that word too, so I try to avoid it. It does. Now, the members of the court try their best to decide cases based on the law rather than politics. No judge goes into a court and into a case and says, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican, and so I need to decide this case the way that's going to benefit my party. At least no judge does that who has any integrity at all. But there are differences in the way that liberal and conservative judges approach the law, and so they tend to decide cases in different ways. It's no coincidence that the most liberal members of the U.S. Supreme Court have been appointed by Democratic presidents, and the most conservative members have been appointed by Republican presidents. That's in, it might very well be the way things are supposed to work, that the courts are supposed to be influenced by politics because the appointment of justices is made by political officials, and those political officials are in place because of how the people decide to vote at election time, and that's going to vary from year to year. So sometimes it's overblown that people assume that all the judicial decisions are just nakedly political, and they're not. But we shouldn't overplay it in the other direction either and assume that that a judge is a judge is a judge, and that that judges just follow the law regardless of their political opinions. Different judges, just like different law professors, just like different lawyers, just like different everybody, have different ways of viewing the law, think that the Constitution means somewhat different things. And you do see identifiable patterns that come up about differences between how liberal judges and conservative judges tend to decide cases, especially constitutional cases.
Like what? I mean, often we've heard abortion being a litmus test. You mentioned affirmative action. There are death penalty cases. What kind of cases do you look at then say, oh, okay, that ruling was made by a liberal judge, or that was made by a conservative judge?
I think abortion and the death penalty are two really good examples of exactly what we're talking about. And the principle behind them, the reason that they tend to divide on liberal and conservative lines, is the difference between an originalist approach to constitutional interpretation and a more living constitutionalist approach. Liberal justices and judges tend to believe that the Constitution's meaning changes over time and that judges should be able to adapt the Constitution's meaning to fit the modern society, including by expanding the rights that are protected by the Constitution, whereas conservatives tend to believe that the Constitution's meaning stays the same unless the text is actually amended. So the conservatives are more likely to believe that, well, the death penalty was constitutional when the Eighth Amendment was written, and so the death penalty is constitutional today. Abortion restrictions were accepted at the time the 14th Amendment was adopted, so abortion restrictions are probably okay today. Whereas liberals are more accepting of the idea that the Constitution's meaning changes over time. And so so those are two really good examples of situations where we do tend to get an ideological divide between the members of the court, because those ideologies, not just whether we agree or disagree about abortion as a policy matter or the death penalty as a policy matter, but because liberals and conservatives have different ways of looking at the Constitution.
Mike, I felt like I've been in a law school class today. Thank you very much for being
here. I don't know whether that's a compliment or not.
Oh, no, it was. It certainly was. Michael DiMino, professor of law at Widener University Commonwealth Law School. Mike, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. It's always a pleasure. You have a great rest of your day.
You too. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The Department of Agriculture, along with veterinarians from the Pennsylvania SPCA and Pennsylvania Veterinary Medical Association, are highlighting the need for a dog license fee increase, with additional funding going to the Bureau of Dog Law Enforcement. Joining us is Democratic State Representative Eddie Day Pashinsky of Luzerne County and Dr. Mary Jane McNamee, a veterinarian at Apple Creek Veterinary Hospital in Lebanon and chair of the Legislative and Regulatory Affairs Committee of the Pennsylvania Veterinary Medical Association. Welcome to the program. Representative Pashinsky, let me start with you. In this legislation, the cost of a dog license in Pennsylvania would go from $6.50 to $10. Why is that additional money needed?
Well, first of all, Scott, thank you very much for having us. And the reason why we need that increase is because at the present time, believe it or not, we're having to use taxpayer dollars, people who do not have dogs, to help subsidize the cost of our dog wardens. Keep in mind, the purpose of a dog warden is multifaceted. Number one, to try to protect people from runaway dogs, from dogs that could be dangerous. We do have those. And years ago, we used to have packs of dogs, which was extremely dangerous. They would kill other animals. And those packs of dogs also killed many of the farmers' animals. And the Bureau would help subsidize the cost to replace those animals. That was one of the reasons. They also play a major role in making sure that our kennels have healthy conditions for the puppies and the animals, the dogs that people buy. The cost of some of these dogs exceed $1,000. And prior to some of the laws and regulations, the conditions for those puppies were absolutely deplorable. The money also goes to help subsidize the cost of our animal shelters. We used to provide about $40 a day for the animals that were picked up, that were lost, and until the licensed owner would be able to retrieve them, the Bureau would help subsidize that cost by $40 a day. Today, they can no longer do that. It's down to $5 a day, which means that puts another burden on trying to find enough money to be able to subsidize the cost of taking care of these animals. So there's just a few highlights of, you know, why the penny a day, we're talking about a penny a day increase from $6.50 to $10. I don't think affordability is the case here. If you can't afford a penny a day, then you can't afford having a dog. So this is a practical, reasonable solution to something that is definitely needed and has demonstrated over the decades. It's not only important for people's safety, it's important for the health, eliminating rabies and, you know, the dog packs and so on.
So how much money would this increase raise?
It raised about $2.5 million.
And so what would that mean? Would that mean hiring more dog wardens, or I don't know, do we have a shortage of dog wardens at this point?
We do. We do. I'll give you an example. In Luzerne County, we have about 317,000 people. We had 461 dog issues, and we had we have three dangerous dogs. There were 151 dog bites. We have one warden for a huge area. That's definitely not, a healthy or productive system when you only have one warden for that amount of area, geographic as well as population.
If you have a question or comment for our guest talking about a proposed increase in the dog license fees from $6.50 to $10 a year, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Mary Jane McNamee, as Representative Pashinsky has described, I mean, one in Luzerne County with the population, and you know, that's representative of a lot of counties around the state. But from your perspective, someone who sees injured dogs, sees sick dogs, hears the stories of some of the conditions that these dogs are found in, why are more inspections needed?
Hi, good morning, Scott and Representative Pashinsky. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity. It's very important because, just to back up, prior to 2008, I think we have to look at historically where we've come from. The numbers of sick, injured, improperly bred, improperly kept dogs were astronomical, really. And the dog laws, which were enacted in 2008, did so much to allow the authority of our Dog Enforcement Bureau wardens to go in and perform inspections of these kennels. And right now, it's my understanding from my friends at the Bureau of the Dog Law Enforcement that not only are they strapped in terms of doing the required two times a year inspections, but they don't have the manpower, the funds to go in and do the unannounced inspections, which are so vitally important.
What you were talking about in 2008 is what people commonly refer to as the puppy mill bill that, would try to, crack down on some of those operations where breeders just were turning out dogs for profit, and a lot of them were kept in just horrible conditions. Are you saying that? I mean, I think we have to be realistic that there still are puppy mills in Pennsylvania, that this law did not eliminate them all. Are you saying that because these dog wardens are underfunded and there is a shortage of them, that puppy mills, I don't know whether it would be accurate to say continue to flourish, but there are still more than what we think?
Yeah, so I would say that the dog laws and what our wardens do in the Bureau of Dog Law Enforcement is absolutely imperative and integral in cracking down on illegal breeding facilities and improper breeding facilities, which we're referring to colloquially as puppy mills. I mean, really what that means is a breeding facility that's operating illegally or under the law. And so we need our wardens in order to raise the bar and to set those standards that we have in the state that we fought so hard for in 2008 to keep people above board, to keep these breeders above board. I mean, we're fooling ourselves if we don't think that the breeding and the selling of puppies is for profit. Of course, it's for profit, but it's how you make that profit. You still have to be ethical and you still have to treat the animals with respect.
Okay,
could
well,
I weigh in on that
ahead,
just
Rep.
One second, Scott?
Go ahead, Representative. Yeah, go ahead.
And Dr. McNamee, if you would highlight it as well. The conditions of the kennels, if it's of a healthy standard, that means you're buying a dog that generally is going to be healthy and will cost you less money, veterinarian costs, et cetera, over time. Those mills, those puppy mills prior to 2008 were absolutely deplorable, that also bred many unhealthy dogs. People paid very large sums of money, and then it ended up where they cost them small fortunes at the veterinarian's office. Dr. McNamee, maybe you could add a little bit to that.
Sure, that's absolutely true. I still occasionally see those dogs and puppies that are bred improperly, but I have at my disposal our team at the Bureau of Dog Law Enforcement to check in on those breeders. So, we're not doing this surreptitiously. I speak to my clients. We talk about the heartache they've been through. I had a client recently return a puppy because of absolutely horrible congenital defects. If we don't have a dog law bureau that has the manpower, woman power, and the funds to go in and inspect these kennels, we're going to just slide right back to those deplorable conditions that the representative is referring to.
Dr. McNamee, I'm curious, when you talk about illnesses, diseases, I hate to use the word defect when we're talking about an animal that you've seen. What are most common amongst the animals that you see that have been raised in these conditions?
Well, they sort of run the gamut. Of course, we have dogs that fail to thrive because they are just loaded with gastrointestinal parasites. Sometimes ectoparasites, meaning fleas or ticks, but usually it's gastrointestinal parasites. So diarrhea, vomiting, lack of weight gain, failure to thrive. But we do also see congenital defects. There are certain growth defects that can occur called swimmer puppies, when puppies aren't kept on proper substrates and their legs grow and form in an improper manner. That's something I really don't see anymore since 2008, since these dog laws were enacted. But some other things that we can see are things like cleft palates that aren't brought to the buyer's attention. Recently, I saw a dog with an undershot lower jaw or mandible that was going to need thousands of dollars of corrective surgery, as well as the same poor little puppy had malformation of the chest wall called pectus excavatum that was for sure life limiting. And these people paid a lot of money for the dog, and they really got taken.
And I'll ask both of you this question. Recently, and I it's not just recent, but I've seen it more often. Organizations and individuals that are advocating for people, families to adopt rescue dogs, dogs that have been rescued, rather than to go to a breeder. Now, Dr. McNamee, you used the term earlier, breeders who are above board. You know, don't want to put a whole industry out of business. But if you would address both of those issues, rescue dogs and who are the above board breeders?
There are a lot of above board breeders that have their own breeding associations, their own standards. There are many breeders in our state who go above and beyond. For example, do every single genetic test that you can imagine to make sure that their breeding lines are secure. And they love and adore the dogs that they breed. In terms of rescue dogs are wonderful pets. I mean, really, at the end of the day, Scott, what we're talking about is love. You know, you can love any animal, but you should have a choice of where you want to get your pet from. If you want to get it from a breeder, if you want to acquire your dog from a shelter, there's no right or wrong answer, because the best quality that a dog can have is to be have a good temperament and to be a good companion for you and your family. I personally have two rescue dogs that are purebred dogs that probably came from not the best breeding circumstances, so not above board breeders. And I love them just, you know, all the same. I don't have any favorites.
Representative Paczynski, this bill would seem to be, I don't want to say a no-brainer, because nothing is a no-brainer, but you're asking for $3.50 more a year, and the money would go for a good cause that ultimately would be for the safe, healthy, the health of dogs. What kind of support do you have in the legislature?
Well, actually, I'm going to reach out to your listeners and ask them if they would contact their state representative and ask for support on this. Some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle seem to think that $3.50 increase is unaffordable or unnecessary. And we're trying to make the case that it is very necessary for the protection of the animal as well as the protection of the consumer and the public. I would ask, hopefully, to promote this idea. This is certainly an affordable, increase in the license fee to do so many good things. And as I pointed out earlier, people spend a lot of money buying dogs, and dog is our best friend, man's best friend, person's best friend. I don't know what's correct today, but the bottom line is, they really are loyal, and having a healthy dog is a wonderful thing. That will save you money. It's not going to cost you beyond what you should be spending in feeding and taking care of that animal. So yeah. I'm asking everybody that's listening, if you agree, to please contact your state representative, your state senator, and say, "Come on, we do have a companion bill, Senator Schwenk." And the senator has the same kind of bill. We're trying to do it from both sides. I would ask your listeners to please ask them to, pass the bill.
And I'd like to add something, and that is that, in my opinion, I think Pennsylvanians have been getting a bargain on dog licenses for at least 10 years.
Hasn't been raised for 25 years.
That's right.
Now, that certainly doesn't keep up with inflation, for God's sake.
I want to thank both of you for being
there. There's more work to do.
Hey, we're out of time. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Democratic State Representative Eddie Day Paczynski of Luzerne County, Dr. Mary Jane McNamee, a veterinarian at Apple Creek Veterinary Hospital in Lebanon. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.